It's such a gift for me to get the invitation to come in here to Vision and be with you all on a Sunday morning. And I'm humbled by this opportunity to lead an inquiry into something I hope that matters. I bet I'm not the only one who heard a lot of explosions last Tuesday night all over town. Yeah, we just celebrated our 241st birthday in this country. And I want to think about freedom with you this morning. And I know that's been the monthly theme here as well. So Independence Day, you know, this grand American experiment that we've been enjoying and struggling with all this time is built on this one, I think, foundational idea. And it's not a very simple idea either. It's individual personal liberty. And originally, of course, that liberty was not extended to anyone but property-holding white males. When Thomas Jefferson, 27 years old, was tapped by John Adams to write the document, the manifesto, that they were going to send to England to sever ties, the Declaration of Independence, published on July 4th, 1776, and he wrote that sentence about, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We know that Jefferson and most of the founders did not mean all human beings, and it's been a painful evolution as we've redefined that sentence, and now we mean by men all human beings, regardless of gender, race, ethnicity, cognitive ability, etc. And many of us even extend that fundamental liberty and freedom to all sentient beings. And many of us even extend it to the entire organism known as Gaia, that even nature has rights. But for now, let's think about human beings. We hold these truths to be self-evident, he wrote, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And there's so many important things we could talk about in that immortal sentence. Like self-evident. What a strange idea. Is there anything today that's self-evident? I mean, people don't even accept evidence anymore. So I think the concept of self-evidence is good and dead. But in those romantic times, what we call the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, they actually believed that as a human being, regardless of your education or access or anything, because you had a rational mind, things were just obviously true. A certain handful of small things were just obviously true. And for Jefferson, one of those was that human beings have fundamental rights. And those rights don't come from the government or the king. They are inherent. And I think one thing, when I hear that sentence, one thing always leaps out to me the most, and that is that liberty or freedom is not a political principle first. It's a spiritual principle first. And then it's used as a foundation upon which a political concept is built. But I'm kind of struck by that this country, this experiment, is founded on a spiritual or a metaphysical claim that human beings are inherently free. And then ours is a political experiment built on that spiritual principle. And I think this is the most radical element of Jefferson's assertion, that freedom is not granted by the king, or it is not granted by the state, or it is not granted by any man. This freedom is inherent. That is to say, it is built into the DNA. It comes with the fact that you exist. It is an inseparable aspect of your existence, your freedom, your liberty. And of course, later in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson goes on to articulate the rightful role of government. And for him, the purpose, the sole purpose of government, is to defend and further and protect and cultivate those fundamental inherent rights that come not from the state, but from the Creator. And so here, you know, we aren't here to talk about political science and all the ways that those things go wrong, but it's a fascinating thing to notice for me that this is where it starts. Now, this is an experiment we're still exploring and still trying to perfect, and obviously we're a long way from perfect. But for any of this to make sense, and this is something we do a lot in philosophy in my day job, you know, it's when you start talking about all these great concepts like love and truth and beauty and freedom, so much of philosophy ends up having to back up and simply stick to the rather pedestrian business of defining words. Because everybody's for freedom, yeah, rah, freedom. But what is freedom? And we all have different understandings of what that means, and it's difficult to have any kind of intelligent consensus, conscious, evolutionary sharing around the concept of freedom if we all mean different things by it. And so that's why it's, I think, just crucial housekeeping to attend a little bit to what we mean by freedom. And I think we can make progress on this morning by looking at freedom through three different lenses: the adolescent lens, the matured lens, and then what I'll call today the awakened lens. So let's start with the adolescent lens. Through the adolescent lens, freedom simply means doing whatever you feel like doing. I mean, at the most basic, kind of crude level, freedom simply means that. Doing whatever I feel like doing from moment to moment based on my whims and desires and whatever. That's being free. And it's understandable that we would reach this conclusion in our adolescence, because that's after a lot of years of childhood where everybody's telling you constantly what to do and what not to do and what to touch and what not to touch and what to eat and what not to eat. And it's just a lot of rules and morals and boundaries and commandments. And you get into your adolescence and you're like, enough. I have a voice too. I have things I want too. I'm not just a puppet and everybody gets to pull the strings. So it's just, I think, part of our natural personal evolution that in adolescence we begin to throw off all of the norms that well-intended people have placed on us. And so that's, I think, where all of our understanding of freedom comes from. But as we mature, we notice, looking back now, that kind of freedom, that understanding of freedom, ends up being just another form of tyranny. Tyranny not of powerful others, but the tyranny of our own whims and desires and cravings and wantings, usually fear-based. And chasing pleasure and investing all of our time and energy building the ephemeral sandcastles of our egoic empires dooms us to a life of mediocrity and suffering and disappointment and damaged relationships. And so this kind of so-called freedom turns out to be a little more than a gilded cage. And anyone here who struggled out of the abyss of any kind of addiction can testify to this. And so let's think now about the second mode of freedom, freedom as seen through the matured lens. Here, as we mature, I think we learn that there's a deeper freedom than the so-called freedom of the libertine, you know, of the hedonist. And let's call this matured freedom. And this is when you learn that your own best long-term self-interest is deeply interwoven with the best long-term self-interest of everyone around you. And so, in other words, you start to realize, you start to learn that there is no me without we, and that there is no such thing, really, as private happiness or private freedom. I can't really be happy if everyone around me is miserable, especially if they're miserable because of me. And so our happiness and our freedom are intertwined with the happiness and freedom of all beings. And as we mature, we enlarge our sphere of empathy. And this even starts to affect the way we vote. We no longer vote just for self-interest, like how am I going to lower my taxes? But we begin to entertain larger, loftier notions of, yeah, but what is the common good? What's going to create the best world for everyone in which I have to share with everyone else? You know, as Nelson Mandela put it, to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. So we learn to measure the value of our private actions, not only against self-interest, but against the larger concerns of the greater good. And then this is the sweet part, that we even begin to take pleasure in the good of others. We eventually learn to take pleasure in the knowledge that we're moderating our private desires in favor of the needs of others. This ends up becoming a source of joy for us to set aside these rather inconsequential private demands for a larger conception of joy and freedom. And at this stage of our development, our pleasure and happiness are no longer measured by the simple acquisition of things or the simple acquisition of experiences or pleasures. They are instead tied to the well-being of others. And this means we're moving toward this third or highest understanding of pleasure, awakened freedom. So as we practice this matured freedom, our separate sense of self begins to grow translucent, transparent even. Now, of course, our private sense of self is still matters on one level. You know, I'm going to continue eating and going to work and paying my taxes and making my art and mowing my lawn, you know, what's left of it. But there's this larger sense in which I see myself now not as a separate thing, but as an element of the whole. And there's a freedom there. Freedom from the tyranny of my own cravings and fears. A refuge that I take in the knowing that we are one. I mean, you read enough Ralph Waldo Emerson and this just starts to happen to you. So real freedom, which is the title of this talk, means freedom from cravings and attachments and the ability to accept current conditions without resistance or resentment, to break the slavish chains of reactivity. Things can happen, but I don't have to have an opinion about it. This is what the Buddha taught. This is what the Stoics taught. We read this in all of the wisdom literature of the world. To move out of the mind with its egoic need to condemn and judge and control and come into that presence, that true presence, where my judgments and opinions fade away, replaced by loving kindness and joy. You know, one of the great spiritual teachers of the 20th century, Ramana Maharshi, he was asked once by a journalist, "What's your secret?" And I love this. He said, "I don't mind what happens." Imagine if you could live like that. I don't mind what happens. How free you would be. To when you are standing in the doctor's office looking at the x-rays and you hear those words, "Well, it's stage 4. It's time to get your affairs in order." I'm skipping right past the dead car battery to the big example. I'm skipping right past the clogged toilet to the big example. This isn't a plumbing problem. And to stand there in the office and instead of collapsing, a smile comes over your face. And you say, "Well, damn it, it's been a great life. I knew I didn't have forever. I'm grateful I have the consciousness of the end. And I don't mind what happens." That's real freedom. And it isn't easy, but it is possible. And we're here in communities like this to talk about not what's easy, but to talk about what's possible. And to affirm it for each other. So real freedom means shifting from the consciousness of scarcity and lack into the consciousness of gratitude and abundance. Instead of focusing immediately on what I am losing or about to lose, I focus on what I have received. It's purely a question of attention, where I place my attention. As Lao Tzu wrote in the Tao Te Ching, if you realize that you have enough, you are truly rich. You ever notice that as you've grown older through the decades and make a little more money than you did when you were 19? Maybe, hopefully. And no matter what your income level through life, it's never enough. No matter what your income level, you got bills, you got debt, you got scarcity consciousness, it's never enough. And you look at your income, it's plenty of my retirement recently, and I was digging through my Social Security data, and it has your income from when you're 16, when you got that first little job at the grocery store, to today. I'm like, good Lord, this has expanded significantly. How come I feel exactly as broke as I did when I was 16? This is a cognitive error. It's nothing to do with the dollars in the flowing through. That's a fascinating thing. So real freedom does not mean receiving everything I want, but cultivating and realizing freedom from want. Real freedom means not noticing the dust mote in your neighbor's eye, but noticing the log in your own eye. Real freedom is allowing the ebb and flow of life to rise and fall unabated. Sometimes we feel strong, right? Sometimes we feel weak. Sometimes we're articulate. Sometimes we stumble over our words. Sometimes we receive joy unbidden. And other times a nameless sadness overwhelms us. And to meet these natural cycles without resistance, without resentment, and without attachment. As Adyashanti, another one of my favorite teachers, as Adyashanti wrote, real freedom is freedom from the demand to feel good all the time. Do you like that one as much as I do? Real freedom is freedom from the demand to feel good all the time. And some of us maybe could do better at that. You know, whenever we don't feel good, we think, oh, there's got to be a pill, there's got to be a medication, there's got to be some spiritual practice, there's got to be a book I can do, there's got to be some diversion, there's got to be some experience I can get to fix this so that I feel good again. And our entire life turns into this job of feeling good. And isn't that just right back to the kid in the candy store? That adolescent sense of freedom. It's like, I must banish all sadness, all depression, all anger. What if today I'm just anxious? What if today I'm just depressed? What if today I'm just sad? Why can't I just be that today? Why do I have to fix it or complain about it or define it as something that I need to find someone to blame for? Now, maturing out of the adolescent understanding of freedom and into the matured understanding of freedom eventually comes to most of us. Life does it for us. You know, you just sort of grow up. But the shift from matured understanding of freedom to awakened freedom, that's going to take a little more conscious intention, conscious attention. To realize awakened freedom, I think we have some old habits to break and some new habits to learn. But the good news is, and we all know this in this room, there are so many support systems to help us do this. Here at this spiritual center, in the great wisdom traditions, in the spiritual literature of the world, and all of the practices that we do. So there's no shortage of how-to manuals and inspired teachers to help us make this shift into a higher, more awakened consciousness of freedom. They're hidden all around us in plain sight. Just when you walk by the bookstore, there's, you know, a couple hundred books in there about it. All that remains is to put all that sage advice into action. And now I could bore you with all of the long list of action steps, but you've heard it all before. So let me focus on just one: meditation. If you're really, and I really strongly believe this, if you're really interested in cultivating and realizing your own deepest, inherent, awakened freedom, you have to finally get serious about meditation. Enough dabbling. 5 minutes every Sunday is a great start. If you struggle a little with it on your own, find a teacher. There's an app for that. A teacher who can help you, lead you into the depths of your own freedom. I lead a guided meditation class here, first and third Thursday of every month in the evening. There's hundreds of other people in town doing that. Meditation is the single most important step you can take into the joyful bliss of your own inherent freedom. And here's why. Because only in meditation can you directly experience this freedom. Not just hear some guy like me talking about it, but directly experience it. Taste it yourself. Only in meditation. Because the rest of the time when we're not meditating, we're in the thought stream. And here in the thought stream, freedom is just another concept, along with all of the other concepts, and it's great. But in the boundless, spacious field of awareness hidden just beneath the thought stream, which we access in meditation, here we find real awakened freedom, not as a thought, but as an experience. As Eckhart Tolle put it, to know yourself as the being underneath the thinker, to know yourself as the being underneath the thinker, the stillness underneath the mental noise, the love and joy underneath the pain, is freedom. Now, I hear a lot of people say, meditation's hard. Have you ever seen that bumper sticker, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance? You ever seen that one? I like that one. I think teachers put that on their car. If you think education is expensive, try ignorance. Well, I'm going to flip that into a meditation saying. I think, you know what's hard? Living in the turbulence of the thought stream. That's hard. Meditation is easy. So if you think meditation is hard, try living in the field of unconsciousness. Bound to compulsions and fears and endless chaotic urges. Okay, that's too long for a bumper sticker. I'm going to work on that later, but. So spiritual awakening is entrance into your sacred birthright, an abiding peace that you bring with you into every situation, what Jefferson called your inherent natural right that you are endowed with by your Creator. It's there. My favorite line in the Gospels is Matthew when Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Such a mysterious thing for him to say. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. And here's what I think he meant. Living a life of struggle and craving and fear, clouded by opinions, judgments, and egoic attachments, that's hard. That's a heavy yoke to walk around under. That's suffering. That's conflict. That's miserable. We've tried that. We've journaled about that. We've prayed about that. We've medicated about that. But surrendering into the wonder of it all, accepting the world as it is, and then moving forward to co-create something just a little closer to the ideal out of that consciousness of acceptance, that's restful, that's peaceful, and that's anxiety-free because you're no longer attached to particular outcomes and results. You just throw yourself into the work just to do it. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita calls it working without attachment to the fruits of work. Working without attachment to the fruits of work. In other words, not working toward an outcome born in the mind, but working in concert with the great unfolding. Knowing that your consciousness and your muscles and your mind and your effort is a manifestation of the one interconnected whole. of which we and everything are a part. Knowing that the universe is working through you, as you, and allowing that to happen, getting out of your own way, that's freedom. Again, Krishna says in chapter 3 of the Bhagavad Gita, when you perform the work of your dharma, your true, purposeful, authentic work, that is Brahman working through you. That is God working through you. You become an instrument or a channel of the sacred flow. Do you know what the most frequent phrase in the Bible is? It's, fear not. My Bible scholar friend Maggie Whitehouse counted them up. She tells me there are 365, one for every day of the year, occurrences of the phrase fear not or be not afraid. It's translated those two ways. Be not afraid, which is another way of saying be free. Free from fear and anxiety about the future. Because when you think about it, fear is really just this pathological need to egoically control what is going to happen next. Fear is just imagining some bad thing in the future that hasn't happened and probably won't, and then investing a lot of in it. And we all do it, and I swear it's born out of our Darwinian evolutionary stage. You know, the caveman who was constantly afraid all the time survived better. And then, you know, the hippie caveman who was like, dude, just chill. And then the saber-toothed tiger got him. And he never had any children and passed on his chill DNA. And so instead, we're all the descendants of really anxious, fearful survivors. And we now walk around Fashion Valley Mall looking for saber-toothed tigers. And you don't know why you're anxious and afraid all the time. It's, you know. So maybe we can let that go, or at least turn the dimmer switch down. So in the end, then, real freedom means freedom from the thought stream. That's how I'm shaping it with you this morning. Freedom from our own cognitive errors. For it is only in the thought stream, or the thought realm, that we are bound to ideas that cloud and hide and obscure our deeper vision. And this erroneous thinking binds us to limited and limiting concepts. So back to meditation. When in meditation we slip beneath the thought stream, we enter a realm of absolute freedom. You know, meditation doesn't answer all your problems. It doesn't solve all your problems. It doesn't give you everything you want. It doesn't, you know, satiate your desires. Instead, it allows you to move beyond the place where your desires and problems have hold of you. They're still there, but they become right-sized, not so overwhelming, so that they cloud out the joy of our lives. So in meditation, we move into the freedom of our essential nature, what Paul in the New Testament calls the inner Christ, our essential sacred nature. What the Hindus call Sat Chit Ananda, boundless being, boundless consciousness, boundless bliss. What the Buddhists call Dharmakaya, or Buddha mind, or Buddha consciousness, which permeates all reality, including us. But here's the good news. This is all getting a little intellectual, right? The good news is you don't have to understand any of this. You don't have to study any of this. You don't have to discover your inherent freedom. You don't have to seek it. You don't have to define it. We simply have to allow it. For it is what we are, and it is what we have always been, a truth obscured from us by the busyness of the thought stream, with its endless fears and desires and attachments and cravings and conceptual webs in which we are caught like flies. So freedom means letting it all drop. And trusting. You know, it's what the religious people call faith, right? Have faith. You could just call it trust if you like. Trusting that we are supported by the grace of this beautiful, beautiful world and these beautiful, beautiful people around us, our neighbors. We are supported by them. When things go wrong, they will fill in what we need. And to know that and to trust that and to let and to feel the fear just sort of leaching out of you. We are supported by the grace of this beautiful, beautiful world in all its manifestations, seen and unseen. To know that is freedom. I love that Zen saying, how refreshing, the whinny of a pack horse unburdened of everything. You only think that you aren't free. But you are. This is what Jefferson built the Declaration of Independence around. You only think that you aren't free, but you are. It is a treasure simply to be claimed, not earned. You don't need to go through an elaborate cleansing process to be worthy of it. Burning sage. Smells good, but it's not required to be free. You already are free. Today is Independence Day. Every day is Independence Day. So happy Independence Day. Namaste. Thank you.